Hey guys, Fly on the Wall is back for another season. That's right, on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Sunday Take. I'm your host, Blois Olson. Today is Sunday, August 3rd, 2025. And it's been a nice weekend, even despite the smoke. This week's Sunday Take is going to focus on one of the issues that Minnesota has been rolling out in the last year and a half, 2 years, and that is the legalization of recreational marijuana, cannabis, pot, whatever you want to call it. It's been a rocky road, and you know, at times you really question the kind of plan of the administration. But earlier this week, we held a forum on the topic, and you know, we could review all the rocky patches, but it's a question I get very often is, how is this going to work? What does this mean to the state? Is it going to look like Colorado and California? And so I thought it'd be helpful to share a conversation with Interim Office of Cannabis Management, Eric Taubel, to understand kind of the way the state is looking at this, the timing of the rollout, and other critical issues. We're also headed to Farm Fest this coming week, and one of the big issues is whether or not there'll be a farm bill or a budget bill that impacts agriculture and hemp. Hemp beverages have become very popular in Minnesota, and so we'll talk about that a little later in the show as well. And of course, we'll have the take. So when we come back, my conversation with OCM Director Eric Taubel. You're listening to Sunday Take on News Talk 830. WCCO.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to the Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever two-part live and online Fluence Forum. You started in 2019, but through the pandemic, we did about 30 of them on the radio and online. And when we said, hey, let's do with both, it added a little complexity. But I think the topic has been complex enough, so well, it fits. My name is Blois Olson. I'm a partner at Fluence Advisory and the publisher of the Daily Agenda at Fluence Media. And I want to welcome all of you on behalf of Fluence Advisory, on behalf of Stinson, on behalf of Minnesota Can or Soda Can. We decided to tackle this topic because I have found that it is one of the topics, cannabis, THC, that I get the most questions about when I'm just socializing. How's this going to work? Where are we? And it's not necessarily consumers or business. It's everyday people are like, how does this work? What is it? Is it going to look like California? Is it going to, you know? And so I think that's what we want to do today is as we bring cannabis online in the state, what is the state of cannabis in Minnesota? Where are we at? How are we doing? And then what about the different segments? So with that, we'll kick off this Fluence Forum with Director Eric Taubel of the Office of Cannabis Management. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Good. Sounds great. Let's just start. Like you told me before, you as an attorney had many thoughts and people didn't necessarily always, you know, need to hear them. But now as the director of the office, everybody's interested in your thoughts. Where are we at in the state of Minnesota and the state of rolling out cannabis?
Yeah, not only did no one need to hear my thoughts, they didn't want to either. So it was like a twofer there. So I think where we are in the state of Minnesota cannabis, the question you sort of lead with about will it look like California, will it look like Colorado? I think the answer is no. And I think that there's a reason for that. And part of it is because California and Colorado have already done this. And like every single one of the 22-ish states that preceded us, they had you know, in like your post-action report meeting, they had some roses and some thorns. And so we've tried to find what the roses were, like what went well, and then look at the thorns, see like how can we avoid that. The other thing that I think that is unique about when Minnesota launched is that the sort of full, to stick with the metaphor, bloom of the sort of intoxicating hemp products had really come into focus basically in between the time the legislature passed House File 100 and even just like a year into the existence of OCM, the scale and shape of what hemp derived looked like had changed substantially. I was at a conference of national cannabis regulators in June, and there was a research panel that was presenting some interesting research on what they call heavy THC users, which I will say is a little bit of a misnomer, because a heavy THC user for this purpose is someone who's used cannabis once in the past 30 days. Based on my now year and a half of this experience, does not seem like a heavy user. But that sort of group of people that have used cannabis once in the last 30 days, the secondary question was, what formats have you used? And they had like one chart that was like every state but Minnesota. And it was like 17% a beverage. And then it was Minnesota. It was like 40% a beverage. And so we have this really different and unique existing hemp market that doesn't really look like anything else in the country. Although other people around the country are looking at us trying to figure out how do you get that? And so I think part of what we've been doing for the past 2 years is building the intentional design that we set out to build, but being really cognizant that this is a really fast evolving marketplace and a fast evolving, the dynamics are moving quickly. And so how do you adjust the core concept of what we want the market to look like to reflect the sort of new reality? And, you know, one of the sort of upshots of having, or challenges that you have having an existing hemp industry, is that with the cannabis market, as we're like planning for it, we can make changes because we're pre-launch, or we were for a while now. But with hemp, making changes has like direct and real impact on existing operators. And so if you want to make a hard pivot or say, maybe we got this idea wrong, you're looking at like someone has to buy new stickers, someone has to buy new labels, someone has to get new cans. And so that sort of complicates the challenge. I think on the whole, I feel good about where we're at with cannabis in Minnesota. There's certainly states that have chosen speed over deliberate design. And there's, you know, pluses and minuses to that. You look at someplace like Ohio, where I think it's like 80 days in between the sort of legalization in the first store. At the same time, those 80 days are basically them just sending letters to the existing companies that are already in that marketplace on how they can go into adult use. This sort of flip the medical switch is a common strategy. And then states either do it in like a low barrier way where they're like, just pay $100 and you're switched. And then there are states like Connecticut that set really high prices. Like if you want to become a combo, an AUN medical, you have to pay $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. Minnesota declined that sort of approach for two reasons. One, because of the way the medical cannabis market was created in the Dayton administration, it was like designed to be very medical. There was very low product that a typical cannabis consumer might actually seek out. And so the infrastructure was relatively low. But that also meant that the 50,000 or so patients we had really depended on those two operators for access to product. And because we know as soon as AU flips on, there'll be a rush on product, like flipping them a year ago, a year and a half ago, would have imperiled patient access to medical cannabis. And at the same time, the legislature and the advocates that sought the end of prohibition in Minnesota were very clear that the market they sought was a craft cannabis market that looked more like our brewery, our distilling markets, where people could start small businesses or even restaurants, right? Like you could start a small business, run a company for 15 years, raise your kids, have the kind of lifestyle you want, and not be sort of like broke after 2 years of it. And in most states, I think we see like a pretty dramatic market consolidation in those first couple years. And so I think part of the steady build out, part of the deliberate design, is to ensure that the market that was sought is the market that we hopefully get a shot to get.
That was a great rundown. I want to continue with your metaphor.
Yeah.
What's blooming well in Minnesota? And are these rose buds, or are they full blown roses? And when will you see yeah. what you want to see in the garden.
So I think we're like, we're early stages, right? Like we're just, I mean, we're just now at the stage where we're like seeing the first buds. We're like, you know, I think we're now as of Friday at 8 licensees, 4 of which are cultivators, right? So, and those are mostly outdoor cultivators. Either this week or the last week or this week, our inspection team will be out to visit our first indoor inspection. Our indoor cultivation facility for an inspection. We've got one manufacturer now licensed, and we've got, I want to say, 3 retailers licensed. So it's like very early days and very early start. But one of the things that's interesting to me is that if you look at a map of where those businesses are, it's like St. Louis County, Asante, Chisago, Winona, and then I think Freeborn County, right? So it's not the metro. We're seeing these businesses in the outstate. The other thing we're seeing is the first early entrants are all micro businesses, that small vertically integrated license. And so the early signs to me suggest that some of the design principles the legislature had when it crafted H5 100 about being a craft business, a small business, and being one that touches all the corners of the state is really coming into fruition. I'd also say that, you know, let's like really just get into the metaphor that like there is a world in which you can buy a rose bush at Home Depot, and it's like kind of halfway started, dig it up and throw it in your garden and see what happens. And you may find success, like you may get really nice roses. But now you're going to know that I'm really out over my skis, because I told Blois before this, I hate gardening. I don't like flowers. So I'm like, I think this is true. But I think if you actually spend a bunch of time developing your soil and then like finding like the right nutrient balance, like you actually take a lot of front end time, you hopefully get a better product at the end. And I think that's the principles we've been after, which is that, you know, speed and deliberate design are often in conflict. And so trying to find that balance of how can we get there as quick as possible, but not compromise and end up in a place where we're spending years trying to clean up what we did in order to achieve the fastest launch possible.
It strikes me that the big takeaway from that is that we learned a lot from a lot of other places. Yeah. And that some of the frustration that you've maybe seen or heard was okay because we didn't want to be like those other states.
Yeah. I mean, I think the directive that we were given, and I say we, like the first 10 or 12 of us in the office, you know, at the end of 2023, start of 24, got repeatedly from advocates, from industry, from the legislature, was like, learn from these other states. I mean, the challenge of a federally illegal substance is that you can't backstop with federal regulations, in the same way you can in something like food safety or you can in agriculture. And so you really only have what other people have done to kind of try to figure out. And copying is pretty quick, right? Like just cut and paste. That's easy. That's fast. Learning is a challenge, right? And so like, you know, one of the things that I go to often is a learning we had, which is those first early states approached cannabis, and they had to, right, for very specific reasons, had to approach cannabis, and the sale of it is the equivalent of selling heroin through a retail chain, right? So there's like 4 different points at which your ID is checked as you try to get into a dispensary. And that doesn't really make any sense anymore with what we've seen in those first 20 or so states that have done the AU experiment. They're like, it actually isn't that much different or more dangerous than things like alcohol, where we have much, much like lower age gating practices. And in fact, we often see positive outcomes in communities that legalize around things like physical violence and domestic assault. And so I think like figuring out how do we recraft rules so that we achieve the goal of not having kids in cannabis stores, but do so in a way that doesn't require every single business to build 4 separate rooms within their retail space. And so that learning process does take a lot of time. It also meant things like this time last year, Dominique Mendiola, who's the head of the Cannabis Control Commission in Colorado, was in town. So leadership was like, can we take you out to dinner? And she's a government employee too. So she was like, yes, but I will pay. And we all do too. And so, and it was basically like, what do you like in your system? What do you not like in your system? If you could start over, what would you do differently? And at the same time, she had just been handed their, newly created, medical psilocybin law. So she had a different challenge that was exploring, I think some of the things we were thinking about in terms of launching something. But so we did that work of going out to talk to other regulators. Our enforcement team took a trip to Michigan. Michigan's interesting because when we launched the adult use cannabis market here in Minnesota, Michigan, I think, was seen as like, that's the model we want. And I think if you talk to operators today and say, do you want the Michigan model? They'll say no, because no one there's making any money because they're so oversaturated with cannabis that the wholesale prices, there was a large operator who idled their cultivation facility for a cycle because there was no money to be, it was more expensive to do nothing or to grow and sell than it was just to do nothing. And so even in those sort of cases, like we've interacted with those other states to kind of figure out what they like and don't like about their systems, what they would and wouldn't change, and then tried to figure out if those recommendations make sense for us. And then how do we operationalize them here?
One of the things you said is what other states have seen in Minnesota from hemp.
Yeah.
From hemp derived products, from beverages, from low dose edibles. What are we telling them about that market? And how do you think that the strength of that market here in Minnesota impacts the entire market?
So I think a couple of things. One is, at first, I would give credit to the Minnesota legislature for the development of the low potency hemp edible license category. I think other states are increasingly looking at a dual supply chain model where everyone's licensed as a solid approach, and then trying to figure out how you narrowly scope what those low dose products are in order to get them to retail in a different retail sort of chain so that they end up in different, not a cannabis store, but like a liquor store, you know, tobacco shop, things like that. What I think people are generally, I mean, I don't even think there's an answer. People are genuinely confused about why Minnesota had this beverage boom. It's like a lot of things, I think a series of complicating factors where at the exact same time we legalized the low dose hemp edibles. A lot of our breweries were just coming off the like hard seltzer craze and had machinery and knowledge and experience to make something new. And so they quickly pivoted into that. I think the thing that I think Minnesota is showing people, and this is something that I'm hopeful that people in industry are picking up on, is that your low dose beverage consumer isn't a cannabis consumer. So the person who's drinking a beverage with THC in it is a white woman in her 40s, probably has kids, and is looking to make lifestyle choices that reflect some sort of like health and wellness, right? And that's not to say that that person can't consume cannabis, but the primary purchaser in your cannabis dispensary is not her. And so I think research is starting to show that there is a different user, both probably for cultural reasons, and then I think also just like, there's just some people that are never going to go into a dispensary, but they will go into a liquor store. They'll go to Top 10 Liquors. They'll go to Certix, and they'll see these products and pick them up. And so I think people have seen the sort of amount of access beverages have to consumers outside of traditional cannabis retail corridors in Minnesota, and see that kind of as a value add, and we'll look at it. I do think it's worth noting, though, like as we're talking about this, the U.S. Congress is talking about completely closing the quote-unquote hemp loophole. And I think one of the things that will make Minnesota more of a model is that we are regulating this space, because I think that's what's happening at Congress. Is there's a number of key legislative leaders from states that have not legalized cannabis and have not taken any regulatory steps towards hemp products. And so the response has been, this is out of control. It's the Wild West. We've got to stop it. And I think as people look at Minnesota, where we don't have as many issues, we have operators that are trying to do the right thing, trying to be in compliance, that are coming to the legislature to share the issues they're having. I think a sort of regulated model offers some opportunity for other states to follow.
There's a lot to unpack there, but your image of the THC beverage user, that fits the focus group that I socialize with. So there you go.
No, I get it too. I'm culturally a white woman in her 40s, so, so it lines up.
What are our challenges right now, and what are we doing to address them?
I think the biggest challenge is the one that's sort of the most unavoidable, which is that for the next 6 months, it's going to be challenging and kind of messy. And like, you know, other states, this is, you know, back to sort of lessons learned. Other states have tried to, and it's a smart thing to do theoretically, right? To say like, let's start by licensing cultivators, and then let's license manufacturers, and then we'll get the transporters, and like build the supply chain that way. The challenge is that if any point you face a legal challenge, which you will face at every single point, and a legal challenge is successful, or part of your rule package for that specific thing gets delayed or denied, you end up in a place where New York ended up, which is that they had a lot of cultivated cannabis and no retail outlet. And then you had people who were sitting on leases with no way to sell. Like it just becomes a sort of problem where if you try to be too cute in staging the market, you end up risking the people downstream. So we went with an approach where like, let's get the whole market going at once. And the outcome of that is going to be, for instance, we have three retailers licensed. They don't have a lot to sell right now, because there's no cultivated cannabis with the exception of White Earth's cultivated cannabis subject to a compact that is allowed to be sold in the state market. And so the sort of messiness of the next 6 months as we start to onboard these licensees and the licensees at the end of the supply chain, they're the easiest to operationalize in the sense that like you just get a, I say you just get a retail lease, but that's actually very challenging, but you get a retail lease and then you have to wait for product to come along. And so I think that's going to be the big challenge is that like we've reached an inflection point where we're issuing licenses, but we haven't reached the point where you can walk down the street to any corner in Minneapolis, St. Paul, in the metro and find a retailer that has a sort of wealth of products available to purchase from. So I think that's the biggest challenge is that like, even as like we get to the point where like, yes, licensees, licenses out the door, we're doing it. It's still not looking the way you would imagine a sort of fully mature market.
We talked before and you said, again, people really, your words have currency now, right? Yeah. And you told MinnPost last week, 150 maybe licensees. We thought that was a good headline and lunch date last week because, of course, we had this forum coming up. What advice do you have for people going through the process to get a license right now? What do they need to know? What can they anticipate?
So the first thing I would say is that, and this is something I think the office is becoming better at, which is that we've produced a qualified applicant guide. So once you reach qualified applicant status, we have like a, I want to say it's 47 pages. I looked at the most recent draft on Friday. There'll be a new draft out if it's not out already out today that sort of highlights all of the things we see as challenges, steps that need to be taken to get you to the finish line. We also early in the process released what we call our Chutes and Ladders board game, which is the like, and it's very deceptive because it's five easy steps to get a license. And then, and then each step is like, you're now on step A1, now step A1, 2C. And you know, it sort of keeps going.
And that slide that goes all the way back down.
Yeah.
The
bottom. There are places where it's like, oh, you landed on this step, go back to the start. But we've also added to that a checklist to get from preliminary approval to licensure. It is a complicated system because you have to get approval by your local government. And if you're retailing, you also have to register. Those are two separate steps, but it seems like they should be one step. And we changed the law to allow it to be one step, but not every locality wants to do it that way. And so I think, you know, one, read the qualified applicant guide. Two, if you know where you want to be, but do not yet have physical space, I would go talk to that local government. I would find the city clerk that has been charged with being the cannabis expert. And I would approach that person, in a very solicitorious manner with like as much kindness and joy as you can. You know, because the thing that I've gotten really comfortable with is that doing things for the first time is really hard. And you just kind of have to lean in and hope it works out. But for a lot of people in local government, they haven't been planning for this for a year and a half. This feels like it just started for them. And so they're also trying to do something for the first time. And so I think having a little bit of grace for them, but also if you walk in with a lot of knowledge about what you're doing, they can start to rely on you and then you can drive policy in a way that's helpful. I'd also say be willing to turn on your communities to activate and advocate for changes. We've seen some locals say, we're going to do a cap on retail registration. And then there's a community response that says, actually, don't do that. And if you do it in a way that can be sort of like, I think, helpful or engaging in sort of a positive way, you may be able to change those outcomes. So we've seen at least one local government go from having a cap to removing the cap based on engagement from communities that are interested. And then obviously you can reach out to the office. We have like a general customer service line where if you have a question, we try to get answers back within a week. The more complicated your question, the longer it's going to take. And for the most part now we're really down to like the very sticky ones. So it sometimes can be a challenge, as we learn about things for the first time.
As we wrap here, there was a new tax, posed by the legislature and passed. There's been some concerns raised about what that means to the market. What are your concerns, and how has that worked in other states when they've messed with the tax rate?
So we are part of a cadre of states that made the same choice this year. There were a number of states that I think face similar budget realities. You know, unlike federal government, the state of Minnesota and most states actually operate in a balanced budget. So you can't just spend and hope. And I think seeing what's coming with some of the federal cuts, both Minnesota and other states that are in the cannabis space responded by raising the excise taxes on their cannabis products. We're in a bit of a unique position in that we're pre-market launch when that raise comes in. So what impact it ultimately actually has on the market is sort of an unknown that will never be known because we won't have a sort of point of comparison. I certainly understand the challenges that the legislature faced, with the budget outlook and some of the, the structural imbalances and the tails. And in the literally most divided houses you could have in the country, trying to find a way to balance revenue raisers with, spending cuts is certainly a challenge. And so I don't envy any of the people that had to make those choices. I think the other thing I will note though is that they did ensure that for medical patients, you still have access to medical, cannabis products and medical delivery products like however you consume your cannabis, with no tax. We've also ensured that our medical program continues to be very accessible in terms of no application fees. Our registry team, is incredible. They're currently processing registry applications at 1 to 1.5 days between application and, approval. And so certainly there continue to be ways, if you're a consumer who this tax feels too much to sort of, join the medical program if you have a qualifying condition or a medical provider recommends you, and that remains tax-free.
The 1 and 1.5 days, you should talk to DBS and see if they can get their licenses down to 1 to 1.5 days. I want to, before we finalize here, I want to thank you, Director Taubel, for doing this. As you look ahead, when you maybe 6 months, a year mm-hmm. from now, what will you see? What do you hope to see as success in the vision of the market here in Minnesota?
Yeah, so I think this is one of the challenging questions, and it's a question we got early and often of like, how will you measure success? What will be successful? I'm pretty comfortable at this point understanding that I read a book recently, like The Hard Thing About Hard Things. It's like an entrepreneur who starts up a tech business. And he's like roundly criticized for the entire existence of the organization until he sells it for billions of dollars. I'm like, an overnight success. I sympathize with that reality, which is that this is hard to do, and it's going to be challenging. And the mistakes are magnified and the successes are often hidden. When I think about what success looks like, I go back to the office's mission statement, which is to foster an equitable cannabis market that prioritizes public health and safety, consumer confidence, and market integrity. Already, I think we're on a great start towards an equitable market. I think of like five sort of components of an equitable market are social equity licensing. For instance, 89% of our mezzo businesses were social equity verified. 68% of our cultivators were, I think 62 of retailers. Manufacturers was about 50-ish. When we get to renewal, we'll collect a lot of data on our licensees and see if that social equity business cadre continues to be at the forefront. When I think about that equitable market, though, I also think about things like the craft cannabis market. Like, do small operators have the same opportunity and successes as large operators? Do we have room for both? I also think about hemp. I think about a market where we neither prioritize nor punish hemp versus cannabis, that both have a space to sort of move through. I think about the tribal cannabis markets. People say, call us an outlier. I call us nation leading in our respect for sovereignty of our neighbors. We're also going to be one of the few markets where we see tribal cannabis partnerships with social equity businesses to kind of create, a new sort of synergy between people who face challenges because of prohibition. And then that last piece of an equitable market, I think about our community reinvestment grants. So much of the work of House File 100 that matters to equity is outside of licensure. It is the automatic expungements and then now the petitionable expungements for cannabis offenses. There are a number of our licensees who spent years in prison because of something we now see is a way to help with our state budget, right? And so like, how do we make sure those people from those communities, it's not just one or two people with licenses, but entire communities that get reinvested in? Later this week, maybe next week, we'll have an announcement of the first cohort of CanRenew grant recipients. They range in the state from far north down to the south through the metro. We're funding things like housing for HIV and AIDS patients, an accelerator for like Black Girls Can Code in North, and a number of other projects like from the Vermilion School District, Beltrami Schools. And so like that too, like how do we continue to prioritize reinvesting these funds in communities that have otherwise been harmed? And then when I think about public health and safety, I'm really tuned into our approach to testing, which mirrors food safety testing, which is new for cannabis markets. Most do like an endpoint where like test for everything at the end and make sure it's okay. We're taking an approach to public health and safety that is risk-based to try to help product move quicker to the market, but in a way that's safe. Consumer confidence, we have robust packaging and labeling requirements, but we're also trying to ensure that consumers have the information they need so they can make informed choices. And then I think the last piece, and it's probably for a number of people in this room that are on their way to being operators, is that our goal in 6 months to a year is to have the best actors still in the market to find ways to enact rules that discourage bad behavior, encourage good behavior, and make sure that, you know, we don't have to, that we're not constantly chasing down products with the wrong kind of stuff in them or health crises and things like that. And so really focusing on building a regulatory market that incentivizes good behavior and reflects, I think, the good faith actors that we've seen advocate for this in Minnesota.
Well, I want to thank you for your time and your access, but I want to take away something that you said, which is one of the reasons Fluence exists, is there's not always people willing to step up to do hard things, yeah, especially in public service right now. So thanks for acknowledging it's hard, and thanks for putting the work in.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We're back on Sunday Take. That was a conversation from earlier this week with Eric Taubel, the interim director of the Office of Cannabis Management. And you can hear that as this rolls out, there's many details out there. That forum also included conversations about city governments and how they are looking at it, especially the city of Anoka and tribal governments. And then as well about kind of what the rules, regulations are. And then ultimately a big topic for Minnesota has been the rise and popularity of hemp beverages that contain THC. I am not a partaker in said beverages, but I've watched with interest how habits have changed of Minnesotans. We've seen sales reports where hemp beverages are now up to 20-30% of a store's sales in relation to alcohol. We've also seen that alcohol consumption is starting to come down. And so here you have a whole new product category in an industry that, you know, is emerged, and Minnesota is a leader in it. One of the issues related to that is the reason hemp with THC became available was because of a loophole in federal law. And that loophole has been not very controversial, but there's still some people who want to close that loophole, including retiring Senator Mitch McConnell. And one of the things that is being discussed in Washington is closing that loophole, which is ironic because as marijuana becomes, you know, legalized in states, it's only a matter of time, people believe, until marijuana is federally, you know, declassified from a narcotic. And so if you think about that, what does closing the hemp loophole going to do? It's going to shut down a certain industry and certain product categories, which is one of the challenges in business these days, is regulatory consistency or predictability from the government. If you think about the big bill, one of the big pieces there was, you know, the predictability of tax rates and tax law going forward. Agree with it or not, the predictability is there. We also are seeing this in Minnesota, and we'll discuss this more next week from FarmFest. But just this past week, increased fees on feedlots in Minnesota were announced on July 31st. When did they go into effect? August 1st. And so These are kind of the issues that I'm hearing about, that we're talking about, and we'll certainly be talking next week at Farm Fest with farmers to understand that and permitting and some of the needs that we have. Farm Fest is out in Redwood Falls. I'll be there Tuesday and Wednesday. I'm moderating a forum on the impact of higher ed and the what higher ed needs to do to prepare the next workforce for ag. If you haven't been on a farm in a long time, precision ag, technology, drones are the reality every single day. And so these are different jobs on the farm. We also have a shortage of veterinarians and other issues that rural Minnesota is dealing with. And so that's going to be much of what we talk about from Farm Fest next week. And I look forward to those conversations as well. When we come back, I'm going to give you the take this week. You know, all things considered, the last few weeks, this has been a fairly quiet political week. But when we come back, we'll discuss the take this week and what else is on the agenda. I'm Blois Olson. You're listening to Sunday Take on News Talk 830 WCCO.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, hard-hitting American history podcast told through entertaining stories. History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Sunday Take. This week's take is about something that really does need to shift in politics, especially in Minnesota. And it comes to mind with these special elections that Governor Walz has called in these Senate seats. And it works on both sides of the aisle. Candidate quality is becoming a challenge for our elected officials. And when I say candidate quality, what I mean is people who are interested and steeped in policy versus politics. As I think about the idea of next year and the number of retirements we may see from the legislature, the idea that many people don't want to run and may have been turned off by running, rightfully so, by the assassination of Melissa Hortman and attempted murder of the Hoffmans. It strikes me that the parties and the party process needs to make sure that they are vetting for policy-minded people, not just activists. Because when we get activists in office, they're less likely to compromise. They're less likely to study issues. And my experience the last few years is that they come into office with a sense that they're already experts in very complex issues like healthcare. For Democrats, if you look at issues like agriculture, they lack people who have been on a farm or grown up in rural parts of the state, and they try to use more urban-minded thinking to deal with rural substantial issues. Similarly, you have folks from Greater Minnesota who are trying to tell Minneapolis what it is they should do or shouldn't do when they don't necessarily understand these issues. One of the programs that has started to address this is the Citizens League Legislator Exchange. And so you have legislators, one Democrat, one Republican, going to each other's districts and learning about each other's districts. That's a great start and should almost be mandated for new legislators, especially as they come into office. But you look at it in city council races, you look at it in county board races, and even congressional races. In certain places, we just aren't drawing out the best and the brightest. One of the reasons is the time commitment and the pay, and who could possibly give up their job for that many months of the legislative session? Who has the energy to be campaigning or deal with the tone and tenor of politics? It's also about the caucus system and who's going to go through that process and how it's set up. There's a lot of buzz about who will run, who won't run statewide next year, especially for Republicans. But if Governor Walz decides not to run again, there'll be a shuffle on the Democratic side. And they'll more likely be more open seats for statewide office. And that there would show the dynamics I've talked about the last few weeks between the two parties and the two edges of each party, the more moderate of each party compared to the fringe of each party. And so if you listen to this program or you know somebody who wants to serve public office, encourage them to, but encourage them to really study the issues, to really get out there and not just go through the party process, but engage in the community. Talk to school board members, talk to businesses, because we have to improve the quality of our candidates to restore the trust that our government needs and deserves. Because if they can't govern because we don't trust them, then, well, I don't want to think about what the next worst things are about government not working. So with that, think about running. Think about the people you know who would serve well. Encourage them to support them of whatever party, or even if they're not in a party. Because that getting good people to run next year, I think, is going to be one of the things we're watching very closely. I'm Blaise Olson. That's The Take this week. You can follow me all week at thedailyagenda.com. I'll be with Vanita Monday through Thursday at 6:20. I'll have some reports from FarmFest. And next week's show will be about ag, the state of agriculture in Minnesota, as we hear and see at FarmFest. Thanks, and have a great week.
Have you ever felt like you were living just a B or B plus life? It's so dangerous to live that, more dangerous than a B minus or a C plus life, because when you're living a B or B plus life, you don't change it. You think it's good enough. Is it? I'm Susie Welch. I host a podcast called Becoming You. People think, okay, an A plus life is not available to me, but there is a way. We are all in the process of becoming ourselves. Listen to Becoming You wherever you get your podcasts.